welcome to the inaugural episode of a podcast about movies, and the winner should have been. My name is Bob. I'm here with my friend Mark, and we're gonna give this whole podcast thing a whirl and see if we can talk about films. So this is, I guess, what would you say, kind of an idea we've kicked around for a few years. How long has it been?
Yeah, I think we've been kicking it around for a while. I think it was kind of a fledgling idea that just arose out of highly opinionated conversations about movies, in which sometimes we're diametrically opposed with our opinions, which can make for a fun conversation. But I think the podcast just sounded always kind of like a fun idea to put it in one spot where we could record it.
Right, right. It's probably, if we're being honest, realistically, just us having a chance to talk about movies on a regular basis more than
exactly
a long-term money-making venture scheme or anything like that. So
that's right.
So that's right. The idea for the title, I guess, as a way of segueing here, is that Oscars, and this is a conversation that we had at some point, the Oscars, the Academy Awards, tend to reward things that don't always stand up. And the judgment of history and the judgment of time seems to change what people think is important and who should have won, whether it's acting awards, best picture, best director, maybe less so the technical ones. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, those sorts of things. When you look back, you think, how on earth did that movie win? Why did they give the award to this? So to begin with, that's kind of what we'll talk about. But where we go from there, frankly, it's just movies. So, before that though, we haven't actually spoken in a couple months.
Not like audibly. No.
I mean, texting doesn't count. I don't care what
it doesn't count.
The youth of today say, has it been since I got laid off?
Yeah, we haven't had a video conversation since then. It's been a while.
Yeah. So how have you been?
I mean, things have been good. I mean, I guess if I just like kick it off from the work point of view, I'm on a new team. So there's that whole bungalow where they're working me quite hard. So it's good and bad to be busy, right? Because it's like trying to meet new expectations, but also like I'm enjoying having stuff to do because I felt like I was a little bit stagnant in the prior role, but I'm enjoying the new team and everything in that regard. And then in personal life, I'm just excited for May to potentially have a vaccination by then. Cause I heard the news the other day that they're hoping everyone can have a vaccine by the end of May.
You're kidding? Really? I didn't hear.
You didn't see this? Yeah. No. I don't know the names of them, but they launched two new variants of the vaccine, which means the supply is effectively doubled. So that means that once that is fully in production and approved, that they're hoping almost everyone by June can have a vaccine. So that's what I'm most excited about because I want to get back into traveling and potentially for my wife and I have like a real marriage ceremony. so those are kind of what I'm looking forward to and how things have been going.
No, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously, as I mentioned, I got laid off. You knew that. I've been applying different places. I actually have gotten through three stages of an interview process with this one. So first, the silly HR, you know, hoops you jump through where they make sure that you're not psychotic and
insane,
you know, you didn't lie on your resume and things like that. So there was that one. The hiring manager and I talked, we got along well. And then this was entirely new to me, probably because of my having spent 20 years with one company. I had to do an analytics assessment.
Oh, so not necessarily a coding interview, but something analytics based.
Yeah. Similar. Yeah. So they sent me this data file with a bunch of, I assume, mocked up data in it.
Right.
Yeah. And they were like, what do you want to tell us about this data? What do you think is interesting and neat about this? Mm-hmm. I don't know what I was doing. So
it's only 20 years of experience.
Well, I function a lot better when I have a goal in mind. I think.
Yeah.
Like, I know where I want to go with this. It's like, this is the kind of information that we need to get from this data. How am I going to do it? And this was very open-ended, right? Like, here's a bunch of sales data and shipping data and whatever it is. And what's interesting about this data? I'm saying, well, there's a lot of things that are interesting about this data.
Right.
How much time do you have?
Well, it's like, and also insights are contextual too. So, because you could give me all the data that a company has, but if I'm working in a specific department or we're in a specific point in like the year in our performance as a company, it's like, maybe this doesn't matter, right? So it's hard to know what insights to draw. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. So anyways, I did that. I think it probably was fine. Again, 20 years experience. I think I was able to move on to
three rounds. So that's good.
Right. Right. There should only be one more, and then we'll see what, you know, the offer is, if there is one. So fingers crossed.
What's the industry?
That's the thing. Since this is a public conversation, I'm not sure I'm going to say.
Okay.
Now.
I was wondering how far you wanted to go.
Yeah. I'm going to stop there. Part of the reason is it's actually fairly small an industry. And so it's not as if, like previously, I worked in an industry where if you say what it is, you know, you could be any one of millions upon millions of people that work for that industry.
Oh, but this is more pointed. Got it.
This is a case where it was like, if I start saying too much, people are going to be like, I know what company this is, and I might be able to guess who you interviewed with. So
listeners, sucks for you. I'll find this out later.
Pretty much. You know, eventually, you know, when we way down the road, casting my eyes way down the road, we have the Patreon, you know, the subscriber benefit levels or whatever. Like, at some point, maybe
we'll trust you guys enough.
Yeah, probably not. We'll never get that far.
No. Sounds good.
All right. Well, so to the topic at hand, there's really one big Oscar snub's not the right word. That's usually reserved more for people that don't get nominated, that should have been nominated.
Right.
Mistake? Glaring error?
Glaring error. Yeah. Mistake or just like, what's the right word? I don't know. A misguided selection, perhaps? I don't know.
Maybe. The point is, it is something that is surprising, right?
Yes.
Which is Citizen Kane. In 1941, did not win an Oscar for Best Picture.
Yeah.
Instead, the movie How Green Was My Valley, which, fine, it was a fair movie. It wasn't bad. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a bad film. But it beat out what is popularly considered to be, by many people, and for a very long time, the greatest film ever made. Certainly the best in the English language.
Not only the Best Picture thing, but like, I think even cinematography, it didn't win cinematography either. How Green Was My Valley, which we'll just throw this out there, was also the film that won Best Picture, also won things like cinematography, which if you're like a movie buff and you have seen Citizen Kane, it's like the poster boy for what's possible with cinematography and lighting and kind of, you know. Yeah,
well, and it gets quoted frequently in other films. You see those homages to those iconic shots that you see from Citizen Kane. And even in, I was realizing this as I watched it again, prepping for this, where he does the applause in the theater and he stands up. There was that, the actual Cannibal Shia LaBeouf video, which is a direct homage to Citizen Kane.
Wait, explain? Because I've seen that. It's been a while. Explain.
You get to the very end of the actual camera, and they slowly pan into the audience, and there's only one person in the theater, and it gets closer, and you realize it's Shia LaBeouf himself sitting there in a tuxedo, watching the performance, you know, cloaked in shadow, and then he stands up and awkwardly applauds like he's trying to get a standing ovation going. Of course, he's the only one there. And that is a complete, maybe not 100%, but it is a re-shot, is an homage to the scene in Citizen Kane where he's trying to get his second wife over with her opera career. And at the inaugural performance,
right.
Right. Yeah.
And so he stands up, right.
And he applauds. It doesn't take because no one else is willing to do it. And so he kind of awkwardly finishes and looks around. And Shia LaBeouf does the whole thing. He does the awkward stop and he looks around and then he sits back down.
Wow.
Right out now of Citizen Kane.
Now I need to go and see that video, not only because that video is hilarious and I love it, but now to compare the two.
Oh, yeah.
That's epic.
Yeah. I mean, it's reached that level of the popular imagination that even people are seeing that without realizing that it is an homage to Citizen Kane. Mm-hmm. And that shot, that moment that Orson Welles creates there, it lives on in the popular zeitgeist, right? Like it's...
Yeah. I mean, to be frank, examples like that, but numerous other examples, Citizen Kane. I mean, I don't think you can go through like a cinematography or kind of movie Wikipedia article and not find references to that film in terms of like, what are the greatest films of all time? I mean, it's going to be thrown in there. On the other hand, how often are you going to see references to How Green Was My Valley? I don't know.
The only times I have seen that mentioned are in the context of talking about Citizen Kane.
So in context of the mistake.
Right. It is fallen into it's in the orbit of the greater film, right?
Right.
It has become a footnote to the interesting and unique fact about Citizen Kane that it failed to win because this other film, which most people have never seen, won instead.
Yeah. So I think we should also kind of mention that, 1941 films, it's the 1942 Oscars,
right.
But there were also several other like incredible films to throw in the mix here too. So it's not just Citizen Kane versus How Green Was My Valley. We're talking like a year in which we had, The Maltese Falcon by John Huston. We've got Alfred Hitchcock's Suspicion. Those are the other two films I kind of watched in preparation for this. So to start the conversation around maybe why Citizen Kane didn't win, why How Green Was My Valley won Best Picture, it's important to note that like the judges were viewing some pretty incredible material for that year.
Yeah, that's true. And there's probably an element of that dispersal of the vote that, you may have thought Citizen Kane was great, but that The Maltese Falcon was better.
Yeah.
Or, you're trying to get Hitchcock an Oscar, which he never did win, which is another thing we should talk about at some point on this podcast. But, Suspicion, I don't know if it was his best, but it was certainly a good movie. I mean, that's a strong film.
I loved that film. And I saw it, just a couple days ago in direct preparation for this. And I loved it. I thought it was incredible. I haven't seen all of Hitchcock's films, but I really enjoyed seeing Cary Grant in a role where he kind of was able to, like, have his weird comedic timing thing, but still be like appropriately villainous. Like I felt the suspense with his character.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Cary Grant was unquestionably at his best, being charming and roguish. But still, a good-hearted guy.
Yeah.
But it's delightful to see him move outside that range in the few films where he does it. Mm-hmm. In Suspicion, I saw another one, what was it called? Father Goose, which I had not seen previously. I saw it a few weeks ago. They had a whole bunch of them on the Criterion Channel this past month. And he plays this, basically this drunk who bums around Pacific Islands, who gets caught up in the start of World War II.
Oh, wow.
And it's fun to watch him play a guy that has very little moral compass and, no beliefs about the larger world or real, doesn't value anyone but himself and is only interested in finding the next whiskey bottle and getting people to leave him alone.
Interesting.
And it, Hollywood being Hollywood, it changes by the end. But it's definitely not, the guy from North by Northwest. You know, it's not the man from The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Yeah.
You know, actually, no, I'm getting that confused. That was Jimmy Stewart.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, that's Man Who Knew Too Much. Hitchcock, it was a movie that he liked so much he made it twice. There's a British film that is a lot less easy to find. It stars Peter Lorre, though, actually. The guy from Maltese Falcon who plays the what was his name in the Maltese Falcon? Joel.
Joel. Wait, who is Joel?
He's got that.
I pulled up all the cast lists
I
in
think it was
preparation
his
for
name
this,
was Joel.
actually.
He's got a whiny little voice. Peter Lorre's very distinctive voice.
Oh, Joel Cairo.
Cairo,
Yes,
yeah.
right. Otto Madison, I think, is the name of the actor.
Is that who
Yes.
that is?
Well, that's
Oh.
what IMDb is telling me.
See, this is why I
Blame
shouldn't be doing
them.
this off. No, I'm sure it's right. This is my problem. I try to do things off the cuff like this, and I'm misremembering those names. I could have
Well,
sworn
I
Peter
think
Lorre was in that film.
my foresight, which I'm praising at the moment, was the fact that I've only seen a couple of these once. I'm like, I need to pull up the cast list because I'm going to be referencing people. There's literally no way that I'm going to be able to remember all their names. So I got them up here. So it seems like Otto Madison, yes, Dr. Joel Cairo, interestingly enough.
Okay, well, then who am I thinking of? Peter Lorre. Well, all right.
But this is a good segue because like I wanted to know what your thoughts are on the Maltese Falcon. Like, first of all, do you like it?
Yes.
Okay, you like it. Why do you like it, and where does it fall? If we're thinking about these four films, which we've kind of mentioned, like where does it fall in the hierarchy for you?
Oh, okay. So in the context of the films that were up for Best Picture that
Yeah.
we have both seen, Suspicion, The Maltese Falcon, Citizen Kane, and How Green Is My Valley,
Right.
I would probably put it number two behind
You'd
Citizen
put it number
Kane.
two.
Yeah, I would Citizen Kane, Maltese Falcon, Suspicion, and then How Green Is My Valley.
So that's not far off from mine. So I'm Citizen Kane. I think we're kind of both in agreement here, right? We call it number one. I would put probably Suspicion number two, and then How Green Was My Valley, and then Maltese Falcon.
Really?
Yeah, which is why I asked you, because I felt like we might disagree on this film.
Well, that's
I
okay.
have a number of issues with this film,
Well,
but we can get into that.
yeah, I'll be happy to tell you exactly why you're wrong here in a minute, but wow. Okay. So, if I'm being candid, I may overvalue this film a little bit because I am a sucker for that 1930s and 40s wise guy chatter that you get in
Got it.
films.
Got it.
And, you know, Humphrey Bogart telling people, you know, it's the stuff that dreams are made of, and that speech he gives to Mary Astor near the end of the film about why he's not gonna, you know, do this because of his dead partner, whatever. Man, I eat that stuff up with a spoon, right? I love that. But at the same time, too, it is a film that I think that subverts a few things that I like in ways that I like and appreciate. So this is probably the real spoiler point here for anyone that's listening if hasn't seen this. I'm going to spoil some things about the Maltese Falcon, and if you don't want them spoiled, yeah, this is the time to stop. I really like that Mary. Please tell me I got it right that it was Mary Astor that plays. What's her name? Bridget, whatever her name was in the Maltese Falcon, the character's
What
name.
is her name? First I gotta make sure that I've got it right. It's not Ruth, is it? No. Ruth Wunderlich is one of the characters. It's played by Bebe Daniels.
No. She'd be like top billed.
Yeah, I need to hear
it. Bridget O'Shaughnessy. I should have guessed. I would have it right. I pulled it up. Mary Astor. Yeah.
Okay, nice.
Big time old Hollywood star back in the silent days, too. I really like the fact that she first portrays herself as like an ingenue, right? She's very innocent. Mm-hmm. She's just needing some help. And she turns out to really be this kind of the true villain of the piece. That's fantastic. Because I don't, it doesn't seem to me that a lot of older films are willing to go there.
Yeah, that's true.
And
she was a polarizing character for me, but go ahead.
Oh, and I just really like, I like that about her. I like Sydney Greenstreet, the fat man.
Yeah.
Being willing to be very, very venal and open about it. He was corrupt. And he was willing to corrupt you too. And we're all going to be corrupt together. Because frankly, that's just the best way. Like, that was amazing. Was it Elisha Cook Jr. that plays the Gunsel? I think, yeah, it was Wilmer Cook.
Yeah.
In an interesting kind of turn for the era, they snuck slang in that hints at the relationship between him and Sydney Greenstreet in a way that wasn't acceptable under the Hays Code.
Oh.
So it's not obvious because they did have to slip it in. But a lot of the names that Humphrey Bogart calls him are rude names for someone who has a homosexual relationship.
I did not even pick up on that, but I was confused by what was going on between those two people.
And even if it was, you know, whether you want to believe that was the case or not, right? Like, for movies, I don't think it matters for the characters to have a life outside of the screen. Their life exists only insofar as it serves the story on the screen, but which is a whole other topic. The fact that he gets so upset at Sam Spade, I think, is driven by his understanding of what Sam is saying about him. And why at the very end, he has had it up to here, and he is just not going to take it anymore.
Got it.
But everybody turns on him. You know, anyway. So there were a number of things about this movie. It's not as good as the story that I think it was Dashiell Hammett wrote. But, I mean, what movie ever really does that? Very few.
Yeah. Can we agree that, or at least decide on the fact that Wilmer is supposed to be portrayed as someone who's, like, at least partially mentally handicapped, right? Like, he's thick.
Yeah, though I don't know
that... He's not in tune with the conversation. He's incredibly reactionary to even the minorest of insults. He's caught kind of dumbstruck in a variety of moments. I was struggling to understand kind of where his competency level fit in the spectrum of the other characters around him.
Yeah, in that regard, I don't know that I would say that he falls outside of the, you know, the two standard deviation band necessarily, but he's definitely on the slower side. He's not Forrest Gump, you know, where he's just not capable of a lot of things, but he was hired to be the guy, to be the trigger man, right? Mm-hmm. He's the guy that you have to shoot people, to hit them on the head, to, he's the muscle, which is also kind of weird and ironic because he's so small, but
he's tiny. Bogart towers over him in like every scene where they kind of directly interact.
Yeah. And,
yeah,
you know, it's entirely possible too, speaking of the film as a whole, that I'm influenced by these characters, not, excuse me, the actors playing these characters. Mm-hmm. I could have sworn that, why am I? No, Joel Cairo is Peter Lorre.
So I was going to bring this up. I had the original.
The other version. Pulled up. Okay. Yep. Okay. Yeah.
So you were right.
It's Peter Lorre. Peter Lorre, Humphrey Bogart, Ward Bond is in this as the cop, who later goes on to do a bunch of cowboy films with John Wayne. Sydney Greenstreet is fantastic. Elisha Cook Jr. had an amazing career playing character roles in B noir pictures. And he is one of my favorite actors. So I'm probably also getting influenced by a lot of this as well. That I see Peter Lorre, and it's not just Joel Cairo. He's, what's his name from Casablanca, who you know, only shows up at the beginning, but it's a fabulous little role. And he's the guy from Arsenic and Old Lace, who is the sidekick to the villain in that one. And he's the incredibly creepy little villain from the German silent film M, where he's the child molesting murderer, right? Like, he is not just Joel Cairo. It's so hard sometimes, probably for everyone, but for me certainly, to separate the characters that I'm seeing now from the other characters I have seen these actors play.
Oh, absolutely. Peter Lorre certainly has a look. I mean, I feel like with those roles you just mentioned, he can kind of be not typecast, but like he has that kind of creepy sort of eminence that just kind of surrounds him. So what you'd mentioned, kind of the pedophile role? I can see it.
Yeah, I think it was it Fritz Lang? Might have been Fritz Lang. It's been a long time. I've only seen it once. It was called M. It's just the letter M.
Yes, 1931. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's an amazing movie. So he's on this killing spree, and it gets to the point where the cops decide that what they're going to do is have the criminals find him for them. Mm-hmm. So they just start leaning on everybody. And so the criminal organization, this criminal underground, is like, well, this has got to stop. This is no good. So they go looking for him just to get rid of him so that the heat will let up.
Oh, wow. It's like your original Dexter concept.
I've not seen Dexter, but sure. But
it's essentially the same thing.
Okay. Yeah.
Psychopath gets flipped by the cops into finding other psychopaths.
Yeah, there you go.
So I think, if I go back, I think my issues with the Maltese Falcon, like, on one hand, it's like I recognize it for being like this amazing kind of like, you know, like stage setter for a lot of noir films that were come after. Like, it is kind of like one of the first of its era in that regard, in terms of its like its complexity and the way it was filmed. But I think for me, like, I didn't. With Humphrey Bogart, I didn't feel like he really needed to flex his range that much in the film. And like the wise guy stuff that I think you're really fond of, I felt like that sort of embodied him throughout the film without him having to put a lot of emotion into many of the scenes. Like, I didn't ultimately feel like the outcome mattered to him that much, even with his speech at the end, right? With the antagonist female character. I didn't feel like the stakes were there for him. And I also didn't feel like there were that many stakes in the film to begin with. Like these people who are supposed to be murderers, I just didn't get the vibe that they would be capable of actually murdering anyone in real life.
Mm.
But that's also because films in this era are not meant to be overtly menacing, which I get. But if I think about like Suspicion with Hitchcock, and I think obviously Hitchcock is kind of known for being able to kind of build that suspense. But if I compare the two, I find that in The Maltese Falcon, I don't fear a negative outcome of the film. It's like whether these people get the Falcon or not and they get away with the murders or not, I don't feel like this, like a criminal sin has gone unexposed. You know, it just seems like a bunch of wise people greedily trying to get their hands on whatever can benefit them. Yeah.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I think, there's several things there that are, I think, worth talking about, that not only is that true. I think that, you know, Bogey's character, Sam Spade, is not invested emotionally in a lot of this.
Yeah.
But I think that's a deliberate choice for his character.
Mm-hmm.
That I think he even says it at the end. He didn't even like his partner that much.
Right.
And I think it's implied at one point that he's sleeping with his partner's wife.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? Like, they're not friends. They're co-workers.
Well, I mean, he switches the naming sign on their office.
Right away.
Immediately, yeah.
And I think that that's kind of the point in his final speech, is that it's not about what he wants or what he likes. It's about a duty or an obligation that he has.
Mm-hmm.
it's not even as if he wasn't interested in the Falcon itself in some way. But I think that he's being shown as that kind of cold and calculating person, and realizes faster than any of them that he's not going to be able to get out from under in, with the cops, coming after it. He's right. Not going to be able to escape that if he crosses over to the wrong side of the law.
Yeah.
And so he makes the cold decision that he'll string them along, avenge his partner, send them all to prison. Done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think one thing I didn't like at first, which was very reactionary on the part of me just being a new audience to the film, but ultimately I do look back and enjoy, is in the moment I wanted to see the real Falcon. So I wanted there to be an ending in which it's like, they take off the outer casing and you've got this bejeweled Falcon, because to me, that was the only buildup I was really kind of excited about experiencing was that Falcon, or at least seeing it. Even if they didn't end up with it, I wanted to see it, or I wanted to know that it existed. But I think looking back now, the choice to not have it, either exist or for them to get it, it alludes to kind of the hollowness of their intents anyways, right? It's like, they're out for this, precious, valuable artifact, but they as individuals have nothing really to stand on besides greed, right? And so I don't think the film needs to have the Falcon appear, because it's trying to paint the entire sort of intent of what they're going about as being completely shallow and worthless and ultimately not fruitful, right? So that's kind of like, yeah.
Not only shallow, but that they're chasing something that isn't worth anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. The quest itself is empty. Yeah.
And you see that too with how there's that interaction between what's the main the bald guy, the rich character's name. So Sidney Greenstreet playing Casper Gutman,
yeah.
Him and Cairo, where they're super upset and distraught that the Falcon doesn't exist, or the one that they have is a fake. And then they immediately like flip this light switch where Gutman's like, but we can try again this next year. And then Cairo's like, yes, we'll try again this next year. They're possessed by the idea of something that obviously is completely, it's an endless pursuit that will eventually lead to absolutely nothing in terms of fulfillment.
If I was a smarter, more literary person, I would, probably make some clever allusions to Ahab and the White Whale and Herman Melville here, but
yeah,
really yeah. Mentioning it is as good as it's going to get for me.
Yeah. It's like, The idea of the Falcon itself was what was leading them on, versus actually possessing it, I don't think would inspire any sort of fulfillment within them. It was just, they liked the idea of hunting it more than they did the idea of actually possessing it.
Even if they're not willing to admit it to themselves.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right, so I'll go all the way back and say, I liked the film. I just think if I consider it in ranks with things like Citizen Kane and Suspicion and How Green Was My Valley, wish we could shorten that to some sort of acronym. I just think I like the other films more. But it is a great film, and obviously I'll watch anything with Humphrey Bogart any day of the week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
No chance of missing that.
Yeah. Part of the reason Casablanca is a lot of fun is that when you realize that it was basically them getting the band back together 2 years later from this movie.
Yeah.
Sidney Greenstreet's in it. Peter Lorre's in it. Humphrey Bogart's in it. Everybody got back together. We made another great film.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't carp if someone wanted to say Suspicion was better than The Maltese Falcon. Suspicion is a high-quality film.
It is.
I disagree that How Green Is My Valley, or How Green Was My Valley?
Was, I think.
How Green was better than The Maltese Falcon. To me, that one felt far more emotionally manipulative.
Yeah.
And that a lot of the emotional beats in it didn't feel earned. Which, okay, maybe, I've seen too many movies and I'm looking at this with an overly critical eye or whatever. But it just, I know coal mining is a dangerous profession. I know coal mining, 100 years ago, or 150 years ago, whatever this was, was an even more dangerous profession than it is today by an order of magnitude or several.
Right.
But the deaths in the mines of the people that died there, it just felt overly cinematic.
Yeah.
His father's death in particular, when that one happens, it didn't... There was too many of those beats. There was too many of those moments. His getting into trouble at school because he was low class.
It was very kind of, I don't know what's the right word, but on the nose. No, not on the nose. It was just stereotypical in a lot of elements. Yeah.
And I could see the strings, I guess, is a kind of the metaphor. Like I could see and feel the ways that they were trying to get me to feel a particular way, to think a certain thing after a scene was over. And it as a consequence, it then didn't work as well.
Mm-hmm.
And of those four movies, that's the only one where I looked at the clock and tried to think, well, how much time have I got left? Not in the way of like, oh, I'm bored, but like I looked at it, I'm like, how are they going to do this? Yeah. Where is this going?
Well, that's what I was going to bring to this discussion is my major critique of that film, even though I rated it higher than The Maltese Falcon, is that the plot of the film is really like saying the plot of a human life. They're taking someone's entire life story and turning that into a film without deciding on a very specific tale to tell. And I get that person's story has very specific elements that are compelling, right? Kind of the situation of where they live, the societal elements of that, the troubles of industry and like family and you know, all of that. But instead of getting something very definable where he wanted to go deep on a specific tale, Ford is just like kind of leading you down what could eventually be like a TV show, like a Little House on the Prairie type lifestyle in a single film. And that's not necessarily that hard to do. You can think of many things to do that with.
Yeah. Yeah. And it can be done better.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to do a dramatic slice of life film where you explore the emotional upheavals that can occur within a particular individual or family's life over time and how they're affected by the world around them changing. And I feel like this is a little unfair. It's probably not, though, because Ford is a great director and universally acclaimed to be such.
Mm-hmm.
But I can think of three or four films by my favorite director that do this in a far better way, which is to say, Yasujiro Ozu killed this theme over and over and over again.
Right.
If you want, even in the movie There Was a Father, which was obviously and preposterously corrupted in its artistic vision by the Japanese wartime propaganda board or whatever they had, regulating cinematic production. Even taking that one, it was still better than this one at exploring a young man growing up and what tragedy and success in his life ends up meaning to him and how he follows in his father's footsteps and in what ways he diverges from that. Like, it's so much better.
Yeah. And this is, it just, I don't know, with Hal Green, that's like Ford's MO too. Because if you look at like his films, he picks very broad kind of societal landscape type stories to do. So you've got, this is sort of imposed, but you've got like the Battle of Midway, you've got the Grapes of Wrath, you've got this film, you've got Rio Grande. He's almost doing sort of like, his repertoire is like Spartacus type films, which are very grandiose in their topic, but to me just don't land on something that's definable enough for me to walk away from the film and say, I watched this specific story and here were the themes that I took away versus just very broad themes about human existence.
Interesting. Interesting.
You know what I'm saying? He chooses very broad brushstrokes on huge topics. It's like, those are cool, but to me, when I want to watch a film, I want to watch something that's like, all right, we're in it, and this is the problem. It's definable.
I wonder if... See, I wouldn't have said that about his films, by and large, but I think that's probably because you and I have seen different subsets of his films. So, pulling up his page here, IMDb, and I start scrolling down it, I've seen Donovan's Reef, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Yeah.
What else we got on here? The Searchers.
Mm-hmm.
The Quiet Man. Three Godfathers. Fort Apache. Yeah. That one's a little bit more broad.
They're very outdoorsy. They're very like, I'm like landscape shots with lots of people. Conflict. Large conflict. You know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying, except the ones that I'm talking about don't fit that mold.
Yeah, they don't all. I mean,
Three Godfathers is different. And not that you're wrong. I think you're right. But I think it's you've seen, you know, the proportion of his films that have that in them is greater in the subset of films you've seen by him than in the ones I've seen. Like, I think of his films, I think of most of them being about a couple people. You know, The Searchers is John Wayne and that whatever, the other guy looking for someone. Three Godfathers is about three bandits. The Quiet Man is about the one character, the ex-boxer, going to Ireland. The Donovan's Reef is about a couple people on a Pacific island, you know, post-World War II, during World War II, whenever it's set. Like, they're all individuals. And there's a couple, you know, that I've seen. Fort Apache is bigger, you know, larger scale. But whereas for you, it's the other way around, so you think of the most of them as being about that thing. That's, boy, I should watch more John Ford films. That's my takeaway.
One thing you can say is that the guy made a lot of films. Film page is ridiculous. Oh my God. Is this matched? Is this rivaled?
147 directing credits.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, some of them are shorts, though. There's a few TV series episodes. But, I mean, yeah, there's a lot.
I don't know if you can... You definitely can't say that about, like, Houston, right? He did not make that many films. You can't even say it about Orson Welles, who made a number of films.
Oh, well, Orson Welles. Yeah.
He also fell out of touch. But, like, this is a lot by Ford. That's quite impressive.
That is a large number.
Yeah.
I wonder who else would have made... Anything like that many. I don't know. Some of those older directors, maybe? William Wyler?
Maybe.
Or...
Yeah.
Let's see. What's William Wyler got? 77. That's half as many.
That's a lot, I'm telling you. I don't know
anyone
who's made that many. I also just... don't happen to know offhand counts of films directed by people, but
I'm in a bad position to do that
to
myself.
Judge it.
Well, but I mean, talking about Orson Welles, then I think part of the reason he didn't make so many films is related to why this film didn't win awards like it should have, Citizen Kane, is because he was frequently at odds with powerful people in his industry.
So this isn't backstory I really know, so go ahead.
Oh, well, so I'm not super knowledgeable. I'm no scholar, but, you know, watching the DVD commentaries that I've got and doing a little bit of reading about this, the person that he was portraying, parodying, referring to in Citizen Kane seems to have been William Randolph Hearst of the Hearst Media Empire.
I mean, it's hard to get away from that.
Even down to the iconic word, Rosebud, is apparently, the rumor is, I don't know, obviously from my own knowledge, according to some, a private nickname between Hearst and his mistress, one of his wives.
Oh, boy.
Anyways, so, again, I mean, he was going all out to tweak this guy. Hearst is known for being the guy that started the Spanish-American War, as it were, by playing up the Maine explosion and, you know, basically pushing the U.S. into this. So it was really, really on the nose for being Hearst. And as a result, Hearst, being the media guy that he is, probably had something to do with why Citizen Kane couldn't win Oscars.
Yeah.
And then later in his career, the same sorts of things. Wells was artistic. I'll say it. He was a genius.
He was an auteur.
But he refused to compromise such that a lot of his films ended up not getting made. Or he would have trouble funding them. Or he would want to change them so much that he'd run over budget and things would fall apart. There were a number of reasons that he ended up not making films or not finishing films. And I think they all originally, or they'll eventually will tie back to that idea of who he was and his personality and the conflicts that he created or would not avoid with important and powerful people that could have helped or hindered him.
And later in his career, he also had pretty terrible habits. he was heavy on the booze, heavy on consumption of pretty much any kind. Not any kind, but on consumption in general. A lot of my research for this centered around watching his Paul Masson advertisements, which I have to say, if this podcast goes anywhere, I would like one of those to be an audio bit that gets featured.
Well, we'll have to look into some relevant copyright law, but I think we can probably pull something off, yeah.
Paul Masson, never drink a wine before it's time, or what, never sell a wine before it's time. Yeah. And then the outtakes. Have you seen the outtakes?
I have seen some of them. I don't do well with humor that derives itself from awkwardness, personally. I have seen them.
So
yeah.
For anyone who listens to this eventually, the outtakes of Orson Welles completely inebriated trying to do a Paul Masson wine ad are there's no recreating that moment. You just have to watch. It's pretty crazy.
No, it's out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he did identify, what was the movie? Chimes at Midnight, which is which I have not seen. I should see. He plays Falstaff. It's a Shakespearean adaptation, I think.
Right.
Anyway, the Falstaffian kind of character is really who I identified with and enjoyed. This guy that is undone by his enthusiasms and his appetites and the betrayal of friends that move beyond him. And it does kind of mirror his own life in some ways.
That's an archetype for him, yeah.
You know? The other person I think of with him is Henry VIII.
Right.
Because, I mean, what do we remember about Henry VIII? I don't know, if you're not a history person, maybe not a lot. But, you know, he seems to have, again, been one of those people that in his youth was actually a pretty great guy in a lot of ways. Great in the sense of magnificent rather than morally upright. Mm-hmm. You know, that he was, again, kind of undone by his unwillingness or inability to restrain his appetites. You know, he ran through a bunch of wives. Why? Because, you know,
right,
he couldn't prevent himself or would not restrain himself. And he got ridiculously overweight. Why? He could not or would not restrain himself. And in a lot of ways, that sounds kind of like Orson Welles, you know?
I mean, yeah, it does. Yeah, he's an interesting guy. I think also the snub, mistake, whatever you call it, lands a little bit deeper for me, too, because he's also acting in these films.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, talk about taking it to another level that he was able to, I mean, we already complimented him, right? We called him essentially a genius or an auteur, but he was able to direct a film with that kind of, that amount of layers, and then he was also able to pull it off.
You wrote it too.
I mean, come on. I mean, I think that's what makes the 1942 Oscars even a little bit more ridiculous is, I mean, on a just a film basis, I think it wins. And then on a complete performance basis, it's like, what more could you want?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. The cinematography in that movie, the shot composition, the shot selection, is just beautiful.
Yeah, it's insane.
There are a number of things that, again, rewatching it recently, the reflection of him dancing in the window, right? You can see this reflection in the window dancing at his newspaper while his friends, his friend and his business manager talked about him, and his reflection is right in between them in the background. I mean, the whole, it's number one, it's beautiful. Number two, it's an amazing setup for that conversation and that point in the plot. The same thing repeats, not in the same way, but the same sort of three characters with him in the foreground finishing his friend's review of his wife's operatic performance while his friend is in the middle ground trying to come from where the office is in the far background and approach him. And then he's cut off by that railing that separates them. They're still ultimately divided. And his business manager doesn't even try. He stays in the far background in silhouette in the doorway. I mean, there's visual metaphors throughout this film. You know, him walking past the dual mirrors reflecting each other into infinity in Xanadu at the end. I mean, you could just go on and on. The thing was amazing.
I mean, I already want to watch it again. I think one of the scenes for me that I really loved, which isn't really that complex to like film in terms of cinematography, was just the scale of Xanadu when they're inside it. So there's like the fireplace that his wife is laying on, that, you know, he comes over and chats with her, and it's just the immensity of that scale and how they captured it. And obviously there's the zoom out at the end with all the possessions, but it just is like, it's like when decadence becomes absolutely terrifying is how that shot makes you feel, because it's like the fireplace could swallow them up without a blink. It's insane.
Yeah. And it's another one of those callbacks to reality with where's that place in California that Hearst had?
He had a mansion on the coast.
Was it San Simeon? Is that what it was?
I forget. I've actually toured it, and I forget the name. But
yeah, I tried. The time I went, it was closed for, I don't know if that was the wrong day. But yeah, I mean, no wonder Hearst got so mad. Yeah. So
when you said on the nose earlier, it couldn't be closer.
Yeah. Yeah, the only way it could be closer is if he'd actually called him Hearst, basically.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're getting down to the end here of probably the amount of time we ought to take. Mm-hmm. Hopefully people are still paying attention. The last thing I really wanted to say about this movie is how I have for years, in a very small, mostly joking kind of way, resented Charles Schulz for spoiling this movie for me when I was a small child.
Just going to call him out.
I'm going to call him out because Peanuts, number one, it was one of the greatest comic strips ever made for about the first 15 years of its run. Mm. It kind of went downhill after Schulz decided he needed some money. All right, I guess that's fine, but then it got really weak in the 80s. But for the first few years, it was really dark. It was really good. But one of the things he did, one of the gags he had, was his character Lucy Van Pelt spoiling the movie Citizen Kane for Linus Van Pelt, her little brother with the blanket, by telling him what Rosebud was.
Oh, no.
And so I have known what the answer to what is Rosebud, who is Rosebud, what does that mean, ever since I was like 6 years old. Like, I didn't even understand the reference. But when I finally figured out what they were talking about, you know, as a teenager or whatever, when I realized what Citizen Kane was, I realized that I knew the central mystery of the whole film that is not revealed until the last few seconds. I'd always known that.
And So this is one thing maybe we don't reveal to people. So I won't reveal it. But I will say I had the blessing of not knowing what the reference meant before I saw the film, which meant the entire film I'm like, all right, where are we going here? But it wraps it up beautifully, of course, but that sucks.
It did. You knew. It really did. And I'm not normally one to really be too bothered by spoilers, but this one, I don't know. it really got me. So.
Well, it, and it's not like maybe you can't, I don't know, maybe you can kind of predict what the reference is going to be. I don't know if you're brilliant or something, but I think at the end of the film, when it is revealed, it obviously, it's like a call to the message of the movie. It's such a sharp call to the message. And I like that it ends that way.
What would you say the message of the movie is?
I would have to say, without revealing what Rosebud means,
sure,
that there is obviously, I don't know, an irony. Yes, an irony in decadence and possession. Because the more one possesses, essentially, the more hollow or possessionless he can become. So the simplicity of what Rosebud represented to him as something that's so definable in his life and something that he sort of desires in his final moments, or at least, you know, has regrets about, calls to the fact of what he ultimately became and how, you know, hollow it really is.
Okay, that's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair. Yeah, I mean, I think he puts... Wells put it in the mouth of the newspaper guy at the very end, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of what he was trying to go for, which was that the answer, which thankfully, in my opinion, because I do like knowing these things, he does not hide from us. But the answer is ultimately just a small piece of the larger jigsaw puzzle.
Oh, yeah.
Of who the man is, which is what that reporter starts to say. That, you know, we never did, because mm-hmm. the characters don't ever find out. the character, he's like, we don't know what the answer is, but would it have explained him? Would it have been the key to unlocking his life and what it all means and who he was as a man? Would we have a deep insight as a result of knowing? He's like, nah, I don't think so.
No.
You know, ultimately, he's a more complicated figure, and his personality and his nature is more than just one thing, and that any great man by extension is complicated. You know, people are not black and white monsters.
Right. And it's also not as if him saying Rosebud at the end of the film redeems him as a person to me, at least to me. It's like even his recognition of that significance doesn't, to me, erase ultimately the damage and the persona he became.
Certainly not. Certainly not.
So he may be multifaceted, but, you know, he lives with his sins, so to speak.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that's what he's saying from the other direction, that saying, even if we had known what this was, this ultimately, apparently innocent thing, it doesn't change the larger picture of what we do know about him, about, you know, how his first two marriages blew up. It doesn't change how his ideals as a newspaper man changed over the years. You know, none of those things are altered. It is merely another thing that we can know about him that adds to this bigger picture that we do already kind of know. You know, like the idea that, you know, I don't know, you pick some moral monster taking, you know, the guy loves his dog. Well, that's nice, but it doesn't change, you know,
exactly,
that he's a mass murderer or whatever. Like, you know,
exactly.
People are more than one thing. Yeah. Agreed.
So I'll ask, because we should, I guess, wrap it up soon. I'll ask, like, what's your favorite scene from the film?
Ooh, that's a good question. Favorite scene. If I have to pick a scene rather than a shot, I think the shot is the one that we talked about at the very beginning that gets parodied, where he's clapping in the theater.
The clapping. Yeah.
But it is actually that larger scene that goes before that, where, for me, the most painful part of the movie and the most difficult thing for me to deal with that he does is the moment it becomes obvious to the audience, maybe to the world, that he is not disinterested, selfless, magnanimous. He's not a good guy.
Yeah.
When he forces his second wife to get up on stage and sing that opera.
Yeah.
The sheer torture of it for her is not done in a way that is easy to laugh at or be amused by. Mm-hmm. Right? In the same way that you can laugh at the Lena Lamont character in Singing in the Rain, who can't perform. She's just out of her depth.
Right.
Where it's played for laughs. This is different to me. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a real gut punch. It's really unpleasant.
I really enjoyed that scene. I don't think this is my number one. I also really enjoyed the scene where his, I guess I don't know if you could call him his closest friend, but where that his closest friend is typing up the story about his wife's performances, right? And just kind of the complete, you know, non-synchronous falling out between those two people and about what really matters. And I like that scene when he's typing it up. I also like the scene in Xanadu where he starts robotically destroying the room.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
I feel like that is probably one of the first times a scene like that has been filmed, but I think it's been done kind of by other films since then. But just the way he goes about that destruction and the pauses in between, I thought was brilliant. I really enjoy it.
It's a powerful moment, especially the way it builds, you know, starting with him packing it, you know, finishing the packing.
Yes. Yeah.
And then he decides to throw the suitcase out of the room.
Yeah.
And then from there, it just spirals. Yeah.
It's like he's destroying everything that he surrounded himself that he thought mattered. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
I don't know if he realizes that when he's doing it, but it's sort of like he's removing all the things he thought mattered in that moment.
Yeah.
But he doesn't cure anything.
Yeah. I mean, we keep going on, but I mean,
yeah.
Yeah. That's a great scene.
Yeah.
Cool.
How do we wrap this up?
I don't know. See, no doubt we'll have to have a conversation and figure out how to do this more effectively in the future. Maybe, you know, if we had thought about this more ahead of time, we could tease another episode, right? Be like, hey, we'll talk about this next time. I don't know what that's going to be. So,
yeah,
no doubt other fun and interesting things, but
expect content.
feels so dehumanizing and so internet SEO optimization, blah, 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 to say content about, This is me being old again. All right. Well,
pray for us in editing.
That's right. At any rate, we will we'll wrap it up here. Who knows? Maybe one day we'll actually slap some music, intro, outro music on the beginning or the end.
Yeah.
And we're hoping. How often? What do you think? Every couple of weeks? Do you think that's realistic, given how this conversation went? Or
yeah, every couple of weeks. That's that gives enough time to really like put time on the calendar to watch the films. And, like, actually schedule this. So,
yeah. All right. So, I don't know. Maybe in a couple of weeks, we'll have another episode for folks to listen to. Anyways, anyone who has actually listened to this point, you know, we'll see here. Probably my wife, maybe my mom and dad. I don't know. Anyone else? Wonderful. You're a saint. God bless you. Thank you for listening. I've appreciated that. And I've enjoyed this conversation, Mark. We should definitely do this again.
Yeah. This has been great. Thanks for tuning in, whoever you are, and expect more exciting stuff.